just days ago, I mean, literally just days ago in Beijing, behind closed doors, President Xi Jinping looked across the table at U.S. President Donald Trump and dropped the name of a Greek historian who has been dead for, what, over 2,000 years?
Yeah, it really is a staggering moment when you think about it. You have the leaders of the two most powerful nations on Earth sitting in this room, surrounded by, you know, interpreters and military aides and trade advisors.
Right.
And suddenly, the entire conversation just shifts to ancient Athens and Sparta.
It's totally wild. Because according to the official readouts that were released by the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs after this summit, so this is May 2026, just to ground everyone listening, President Xi explicitly asked if the U.S. and China could overcome the Thucydides trap.
He literally named it right there in the room.
Right in the room. And the fallout from that specific phrase being used at the leader level is, well, it's completely dominating the news cycle right now.
Oh, absolutely. When diplomatic rhetoric collides with that level of historical anxiety, I mean, we really have to pay attention.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because why is an ancient historian the dead center of a superpower summit? And more importantly for you, the listener, what does that actually mean for the future of human civilization?
Because that is really what is on the table here. It's not just a history lesson.
Exactly. And to make sense of what just happened at that summit, we are pulling from a remarkably timely primary source today. It's an academic white paper published just this month by Dr. Bechara Soheili.
And the title is Beyond the Thucydides Trap, right?
Yes, Beyond the Thucydides Trap. And what makes this paper so compelling to me is Dr. Soheili's background. He is actually a physician.
Right, a clinical doctor.
A clinical doctor, yeah. But he's also a systems thinker who integrates clinical medicine, peace theory, and civilizational repair into his geopolitical analysis. So he is looking at the global world order, not, you know, not like a political scientist tracking poll numbers.
Right, he's looking at it the way a doctor looks at a highly stressed biological organism in the ICU.
Which is such a refreshing perspective. It cuts through the usual noise.
It really does. He's treating this entire geopolitical rivalry as a patient that is currently failing a massive physiological stress test.
Now, before we dive into the actual mechanics of that stress test, I want to be very, very upfront with you about how we're approaching this today.
Yeah, that's important to clarify.
Because this white paper deals heavily with two current highly polarizing administrations, the Trump administration and the Xi administration. So we need to explicitly state that our goal today isn't to play political referee.
Definitely not.
We are not endorsing any national viewpoints. We aren't taking sides. And we certainly aren't advocating for specific policies from either side.
Exactly. Our sole mission today is just to impartially unpack the fascinating theoretical framework presented in this academic white paper. We're looking at the structure of the ideas.
Right. We're examining the plumbing of the international system to understand why it's leaking rather than, you know, debating who turned on the faucet.
I love that analogy. It's perfectly put.
Thanks. So let's start with the leak itself, the Thucydides trap. Xi Jinping brought it up. What exactly is the trap, mechanically speaking?
Well, the term itself was popularized by the political scientist Graham Allison. And it describes the severe structural stress, the extreme friction, really, that inevitably arises when a rising power threatens to displace an established ruling power.
So China and the U.S., obviously.
Exactly. It's a systemic anxiety. The established power fears losing its position and security, while the rising power feels constrained and, well, disrespected.
And Dr. Soheili's paper actually cites some incredibly sobering data from the Harvard Belfer Center to back up just how dangerous this anxiety is.
Oh, the historical case studies.
Yes. They looked at the historical record over the past 500 years and identified 16 specific cases where this exact dynamic occurred. A rising power challenging a ruling power.
And the outcome was not great.
Not great at all. Out of those 16 cases, 12 ended in all-out war.
12 out of 16.
12 out of 16. Those are terrible odds.
They are. But what's fascinating here is the context of the summit. Because President Xi didn't bring up the Thucydides trap to declare that war was imminent.
Right. It wasn't a threat.
No. He brought it up alongside proposals for what the readout called a new paradigm of major country relations.
And constructive strategic stability, I think, was the other phrase.
Yes. So he was essentially asking if the trap could be avoided.
But the white paper argues that even talking about the Thucydides trap in this way You know, even bringing it up as a hurdle to jump over is incredibly dangerous if leaders aren't careful about how they frame it.
Because words matter at that level.
Absolutely. Dr. Saheeli draws a really sharp distinction between treating the trap as a diagnosis versus treating it as a destiny.
Yes, and this is foundational to everything else we were going to discuss today. Because in conventional strategic circles, the Thucydides trap is often treated like, well, like the law of gravity.
Like it's just this unavoidable mechanical force.
Exactly. But Dr. Saheeli warns that if leaders internalize this historical pattern as fate, they unconsciously begin to inhabit the roles assigned to them by the script.
Oh, wow. So by constantly talking about the Thucydides trap as this inevitable gravitational pull, Washington and Beijing might actually engineer the exact conflict they are trying to prevent.
That is the real danger.
It reminds me of a psychological dynamic you see in relationships all the time. Imagine a married couple, right?
Okay, a married couple.
And one day, they read a highly publicized statistic that says 50% of all marriages end in a bitter divorce.
Which is a terrifying statistic to read.
Right, so it spooks them. And entirely out of a desire for self-protection, the husband decides he should probably start secretly squirreling away some money in a separate account. Just in case.
Just to be safe.
Exactly. But the wife notices he's being secretive and emotionally withdrawing, so she gets anxious, assumes the worst, and starts spending more time at work.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, maybe she even quietly consults a lawyer just to understand her options. Then the husband sees a lawyer's number on her phone, assumes she's planning an exit, and preemptively files for divorce to protect his assets.
Wow.
The defensive, fear-based actions they took strictly to protect themselves from the divorce statistic are the exact mechanisms that caused the divorce.
That is the exact mechanism of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it perfectly illustrates what the paper calls the narrowing of imagination.
The narrowing of imagination. I like that phrase.
Yeah, because the Thucydides trap doesn't magically cause a war out of nowhere. What it does is generate an atmosphere of pervasive fear and miscalculation.
So purely defensive moves are interpreted by the other side as aggressive provocations.
Exactly. The rising power China, in this dynamic, says, hey, we just want recognition. We want secure access to global markets and room to develop our economy.
Which makes sense from their perspective.
Right. But the established power, the U.S., looks at that growth and fears a total loss of global control and credibility.
So the established power pushes back. Maybe through tariffs or, you know, military alliances, just to maintain the status quo.
And the rising power sees that pushback not as the maintenance of order, but as a deliberate strategy of containment and encirclement.
So suddenly, the system narrows the imagination of the leaders.
Yeah.
Everything becomes a zero-sum game until war begins to look like a tragic necessity rather than a catastrophic failure of diplomacy.
Exactly. You get locked into the script.
Okay, I see the logic there, but let me push back on Dr. Saheeli's premise for a second here.
Sure, go for it.
Isn't some baseline level of self-interest and, frankly, paranoia just fundamental human nature?
No.
Especially at the level of nation states. I mean, states have an absolute obligation to protect themselves. Can global superpowers really just decide to ignore the structural rivalry?
It's a fair question.
Because if you're sitting in the Pentagon or the Politburo, you can't just pretend the other guy isn't rapidly building hypersonic missiles or launching new aircraft carriers. You have to react.
You're absolutely right. And Dr. Saheeli isn't suggesting that states should become naive or just blindly ignore the reality of military buildup.
Okay, good. Because that would be a tough sell.
It would be. He is saying that the Thucydides trap must be treated strictly as a diagnostic tool, not as an inevitable prophecy.
A diagnostic tool.
Right. A diagnostic opens the future. Just shows you exactly where the system's failing and where the patient's vitals are dropping, allowing you to actually intervene.
Ah, okay. Whereas a prophecy closes the future and tells you intervention is useless.
Precisely. But this leads to his most radical point, which really flips traditional geopolitics completely on its head.
Okay, let's hear it.
He argues that the real trap isn't just that China is rising and America is fearful. The deeper, much more insidious trap is what he calls the life-blind security paradigm.
Life-blind security. When I read that phrase in the source material, I mean, it stopped me in my tracks.
It's a heavy concept.
What does it actually mean to be life-blind?
A life-blind security paradigm is a worldview where a state seeks to guarantee its own safety through the active insecurity of others.
Through the insecurity of others.
Okay. It's a system where we measure our safety purely by our capacity to destroy. We count the number of nuclear warheads. We measure the range of our ballistic missiles. We track our technological supremacy in AI.
And we leverage our control over economic supply chains.
Yes, but, and here is the fatal flaw, we entirely detach those measurements of security from the living systems that actually keep human beings alive.
So we detach them from the air, the water, the human bodies.
Exactly, from agricultural systems and the medical supply lines.
So we define security purely in terms of weapons and dominance, completely forgetting what those weapons were originally supposed to protect in the first place.
Exactly.
This is like, think of a medieval king who decides to build a massive, impenetrable fortress to keep his enemies out. He builds the walls so high and thickens them so much that eventually he paves over all the fertile farmland inside the fortress just to make room for more catapults and armories.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it.
And he even poisons his own wells just to make sure an invading spy couldn't drink from them. From a purely military standpoint, he is perfectly secure from the outside.
But he and his people are going to starve to death on the inside.
Exactly.
Dr. Sakelli points out the profound absurdity of this. You can heavily fortify your borders. You can have the most advanced stealth bombers in the world while entirely neglecting the physical bodies and the social cohesion of your own citizens.
Yeah, you can ruthlessly secure your microchip supply chains while completely degrading the global ecosystems that actually produce your food.
And you can maintain a massive nuclear deterrent. But if your public health infrastructure is collapsing, if social trust is completely shattered, and if the planetary climate is destabilizing, what exactly have you secured?
Nothing. I mean, you've secured a heavily armed wasteland.
Exactly. And that is the core of the lifeline trap. We are playing a geopolitical game of chess, obsessing over capturing pieces, completely ignoring the fact that the actual board we are playing on is catching fire.
Wow. Okay. So if the Thucydides trap is just a diagnostic tool, how do we actually take the patient's vitals?
We have to measure the system differently.
Right. If we aren't just counting aircraft carriers anymore, how do we measure the actual health and stability of this global U.S.-China ecosystem right now following this May 2026 summit?
Well, the white paper uses a framework called the seven primitives of viability.
It's the seven primitives.
Think of these as the physiological markers used during a civilizational stress test. In clinical medicine, a doctor puts a patient on a treadmill to reveal their physiological limits.
Right, to see how their heart reacts under pressure before they have a massive coronary event.
Exactly. In international relations, Dr. Saheeli is essentially putting the world order on a treadmill to see if it can preserve its life capacity when a major disturbance hits.
Let's explore how these primitives actually function, because applying them to the current U.S.-China dynamic is incredibly revealing.
It really is.
And I don't want to just, you know, read a list here. Let's really look at how these elements interact.
Yeah.
If we are examining the patient, the first thing we notice is how restricted their movement is. The paper calls this the constraint on the system.
Right. What limits the field of action? In this specific rivalry, the constraints are massive and rigid.
We are talking about vast nuclear arsenals.
Vast nuclear arsenals, complex and inflexible military alliances, the rapid integration of AI systems, and deep, unyielding domestic nationalism in both countries.
Yeah, that nationalism is a huge factor.
Constraints drastically limit a leader's flexibility. When an issue like Taiwan becomes heavily symbolized and militarized, it morphs into a sacred constraint.
Meaning it becomes almost impossible for either side to negotiate or compromise without suffering severe, potentially regime-ending humiliation domestically.
Exactly. You are locked in.
And when you have that level of constraint, when you are tightly bound in a straitjacket of nationalism and military posturing, you desperately need slack in the system, which the paper calls the margin.
And margin is arguably the most critical vital sign of all.
Really? Why is that?
Because margin is the shock absorber. It's the literal space between a sudden disturbance and a total catastrophic breakdown.
Okay, so give me an example of what margin looks like in real life.
Margin is the presence of trust. It's having reliable communication channels that actually work during a crisis. It's having enough decision time for leaders to think critically. It's having buffers in your economic supply chain so that if one port closes, your country doesn't run out of antibiotics in a week.
Oh, that makes total sense. So right now, in May 2026, trust between Washington and Beijing is virtually non-existent.
Which means the margin is paper thin.
Meaning the shock absorbers on the car are completely shot. If we hit a bump, the axle just snaps.
Exactly. And because the margin is so thin, the overall state of the system, its current condition, is what Dr. Saheeli defines as managed instability.
Managed instability.
It's a high arousal, hypervigilant rivalry under only partial regulation. We are neither in a state of peace nor a state of war.
Both sides clearly recognize the horrific danger of military escalation.
Yes, but neither side has done the foundational work to repair the underlying structural conditions generating that danger.
Which makes the system incredibly vulnerable to a disturbance.
That's the next primitive.
Yeah. Right. The system is highly constrained, lacks margin, and is deeply unstable. What happens when a shock hits it?
The paper mentions hypotheticals like a massive cyber attack on infrastructure or an autonomous AI command error.
But it also zeroes in on a very real, very immediate example from the recent summit readouts, the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes, this is a vital real-world application of the theory. According to Reuters reporting on the summit, President Trump stated that President Xi agreed that Iran must reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
But the Chinese readouts didn't actually officially confirm that specific commitment, did they?
No, they didn't. They primarily criticized the broader conflict as something that shouldn't have happened in the first place.
Let's pause and really look at the mechanics of the Strait of Hormuz for a second, because it perfectly illustrates this whole concept of margin.
It really does.
This isn't just a random body of water. The Strait of Hormuz is a massive global bottleneck. The paper notes it carries roughly one-fifth of the world's global oil consumption.
And a huge portion of its liquefied natural gas.
Right. So imagine the strait gets completely shut down due to a regional conflict. Let's trace the ripple effect to see how a regional disturbance tests the entire global system's margin.
What's fascinating here is, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it isn't just about ships stuck in the Middle East. A sudden, massive shock to global oil and gas routes instantly equals a severe spike in inflation worldwide.
Right. Suddenly it costs dramatically more to transport groceries to a supermarket in Ohio or to manufacture goods in Guangdong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And a rapid, uncontrollable inflation inevitably equals widespread social anger and economic pain.
Because citizens demand solutions from their governments.
Always. That social anger creates intense nationalist populist pressure on politicians. And here's where the margin entirely vanishes.
How so?
Because intense domestic political pressure drastically narrows the diplomatic space that leaders have to maneuver.
Because if a sitting U.S. president is facing midterm elections with gas at $10 a gallon and a furious electorate, they cannot afford to look weak on the global stage.
They're forced to take a hardline stance.
Yes. And similarly, if Beijing is facing economic slowdowns and social unrest due to energy shortages, they might feel compelled to project strength externally to maintain internal cohesion.
Exactly. So a regional choke point closing suddenly pushes Washington and Beijing closer to the brink of direct conflict, not because they actively wanted a war,
but because their domestic margins just evaporated.
Yes.
That completely upends the traditional definition of power for me.
It's a huge shift.
Because the way I was always taught, power was simply the ability to project force. It was the ability to deploy a carrier strike group or win a conventional war.
That's the old model.
But under Dr. Sicali's framework, power is the ability to preserve margin. True power is having enough slack, enough resilience built into your society so that a single disturbance in the Middle East doesn't drag your nation into World War III.
Power is shock absorption.
Power is shock absorption. I love that.
It is a profound paradigm shift, and it explains why the current perception, which is another primitive between the U.S. and China, is so incredibly dangerous.
Right. Perception.
This is the classic security dilemma. Because margins are so thin, perceptions harden instantly into absolutes. Each side views its own actions as entirely defensive and necessary,
while viewing the exact same actions by the other side as aggressively revisionist.
Exactly. The U.S. looks at its military alliances in the Pacific and its restrictions on advanced technology exports as necessary steps to protect a rules-based international order.
But China looks at those exact same alliances and tech bans as a deliberate hostile strategy of containment and economic strangulation.
And every single ambiguity is immediately read as hostile intent.
Which is why the current mechanisms of regulation, the tools we use to keep the system from breaking down, are struggling so badly.
Yeah, things like summits, military hotlines, and trade talks.
The constructive strategic stability that she proposed is a form of regulation, but the paper argues it is just too thin.
It relies way too much on elite-level, top-down crisis management. I mean, a hotline might help manage a crisis at the last possible second, but it does absolutely nothing to cure the underlying disease.
Leaving us with our current options, the final primitive. And looking at the board through this diagnostic lens, our options seem incredibly bleak.
They really do.
We are basically staring down three paths. Unmanaged escalation, which is catastrophic war.
Yeah.
Hard decoupling, which shatters the global economy and causes immense human suffering. Or an unstable, highly transactional detente that just kicks the can down the road until the next crisis hits.
And the reason our options look so bleak is because we are still diagnosing the situation using the vocabulary of shallow realism.
Shallow realism, and this is where we really need to shatter some deeply held illusions.
Yes, section 3 of the white paper.
Dr. Sahili essentially takes a sledgehammer to the outdated geopolitical concepts that got us into this mess in the first place. We've diagnosed the disease, but now we have to confront the fact that the very vocabulary we use to describe world politics is fundamentally flawed.
The paper draws some crucial distinctions here, starting with the idea of stability itself. The first illusion to shatter is the belief that strategic stability is the same thing as peace.
Right. They're not the same.
Not at all. To explain why this is false, Dr. Sahili draws on Johann Galtung's foundational concept of negative peace versus positive peace.
Let's make sure that distinction is crystal clear for you listening. How does Galtung define them?
Negative peace is simply the absence of direct physical violence. It just means nobody is currently shooting at each other. Strategic stability, putting diplomatic guardrails on a bitter rivalry so you don't accidentally blow up the world with nuclear weapons, is merely a form of negative peace.
And what's positive peace?
Positive peace requires the active transformation of the structural conditions that are causing the friction and inequality in the first place.
To bring it back to the medical analogy, negative peace is basically putting a tourniquet on a wound so the patient doesn't actively bleed to death on the floor.
Right. It's necessary, yes.
But positive peace is actually administering the antibiotics to cure the underlying infection.
That's it, exactly. Strategic stability just manages the decay. It puts a temporary floor under the rivalry, but it doesn't build a house you can actually live in.
You can have perfect strategic stability while still engaging in vicious economic warfare.
And funding proxy conflicts in developing nations.
And accelerating global ecological destruction.
Exactly.
Okay, the second illusion the paper shatters is incredibly relevant to everyone listening because it's about the things we buy and consume every single day.
The illusion of global trade.
Yes. The paper states that interdependence is not life coherent when it degrades into hostage dependence.
This is huge. For decades, the entire philosophy of globalization was built entirely around one metric. Efficiency.
Efficiency above all else.
Corporations build hyper-complex, just-in-time global supply chains for everything from advanced semiconductors to rare earth minerals to basic life-saving medicines.
It was an architecture designed exclusively to maximize profit margins, not to maximize human resilience.
And the terrifying consequence of prioritizing efficiency over resilience is that those exact supply chains have now been weaponized.
Let's look at APIs, active pharmaceutical ingredients.
I'll set the perfect example.
If one nation controls the vast majority of the chemical precursors needed to make basic antibiotics, insulin or blood pressure medication, and a geopolitical conflict breaks out,
that trade relationship isn't mutual flourishing.
No. If you can shut off another country's access to life-saving medicine by closing a port, you are essentially holding a gun to the head of their civilian population.
It isn't interdependence. It's mutual hostage-taking.
You've outsourced your life capacity to a strategic rival.
Precisely. And the third illusion Dr. Sahili identifies is perhaps the most dangerous myth of the 21st century. The deeply ingrained belief that technological supremacy automatically equals civilizational progress.
We see this everywhere in the news. The desperate, frantic race for artificial intelligence, quantum computing, autonomous drone swarms.
It's always framed as a necessary race to the future.
Yet the paper points out a glaring omission from the May 2026 summit. Despite all the high-level talks, AI was notably left completely unresolved.
The Guardian actually reported that there were no tangible breakthroughs or constraints agreed upon regarding the AI arms race.
Which is utterly terrifying from a systems perspective, because AI and autonomous weapons do something extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
They drastically compress decision times.
They do. Let's dig into how that compression actually works. Because it's not just about computers being faster. It's about what that speed eliminates.
It eliminates the human margin required for wisdom and restraint.
To understand why this matters, think about the famous historical case of Stanislav Petrov.
Oh, this is the perfect example. Walk us through what happened there.
It was September 1983, at the height of the Cold War. Stanislav Petrov was a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Air Defense Forces.
Okay.
He was the duty officer at the command center for the Oko nuclear early warning system. Suddenly, the system's alarms just go off.
The computers report that the United States has launched an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Then another. Then three more. The system is literally screaming that five American nuclear missiles are inbound toward the Soviet Union.
The protocol in that moment is absolute. He is supposed to report the incoming attack to his superiors.
Which would almost certainly trigger a massive retaliatory nuclear strike by the Soviet Union, World War III.
But Petrov hesitates.
He has a few agonizing minutes to make a decision, and he uses his human judgment.
He reasons that if the United States were going to launch a preemptive first strike, they wouldn't just send five missiles.
Right. They would send hundreds in an overwhelming attack to cripple Soviet defenses. Five missiles made no strategic sense.
He also knew the early warning satellite system was relatively new and prone to glitches.
So, against all protocol, he reports the alarm as a system malfunction.
And he was right. It turned out the satellite had misinterpreted the sun's reflection off the tops of high-altitude clouds as missile launches.
Human intuition, human doubt, save the world.
Now, apply that to the modern AI arms race.
If you have autonomous algorithms detecting a perceived threat, say a cyber intrusion or a hypersonic missile launch, and those algorithms are programmed to decide and execute a counterstrike in milliseconds.
Human diplomacy and human doubt are entirely bypassed. Stanislav Petrov is permanently removed from the loop.
Exactly. Technology that increases the speed of military escalation far beyond the capacity for human deliberation is not progress. It is accelerated fragility.
Which brings us to the most critical and, frankly, the most sensitive distinction in the entire white paper.
The illusion of how the world talks about Taiwan.
The paper insists, forcefully, that Taiwan must not be reduced to a strategic abstraction.
It cannot simply be labeled a flashpoint, a trigger, an island chain node, or a semiconductor factory in a great power game.
And the recent summit fallout highlights just how intensely fraught this is.
According to the readouts, Xi called Taiwan the absolute most important and sensitive issue in China-U.S. relations, explicitly warning that mishandling it could lead to conflict.
Meanwhile, Reuters reported that President Trump made no specific public commitment on arms sales to Xi during the meeting, but acknowledged they discussed it.
And almost immediately after the summit concluded, Taiwan publicly pressed their case for continued U.S. arms sales to maintain regional deterrence.
The geopolitical posturing from all sides is immense, but Dr. Sahili's framework demands that we completely reframe the ethical floor of this conversation.
Taiwan is not just a strategic asset. It is a living society.
It is a complex ecology of millions of human beings, families, hospitals, schools, and rich cultural histories.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You turn on the television and you hear pundits and think tank analysts talking about Taiwan as if it's a poker chip on a casino table.
Right. If the U.S. plays this chip, how will China raise the bet?
It completely divorces the conversation from the physical reality on the ground.
A much better analogy would be looking at the structural integrity of a house. Taiwan isn't a poker chip you can gamble with. It is a load-bearing pillar in the global civilizational structure.
If you start hacking away at a load-bearing pillar just to prove a point to your neighbor, you are going to accidentally collapse the roof on your own head.
Treating millions of lives as a bargaining chip isn't just morally grotesque. It's systemically suicidal.
It is.
But I have to interrupt myself and push back here for a second.
Okay, go ahead.
Because as much as I appreciate the moral clarity of that view, how does an abstract ethical floor actually stop a physical military blockade or an amphibious assault?
It's the classic realist question.
Right. A shift in philosophical perspective doesn't sink a battleship or shoot down a drone.
That is the ultimate realist critique. Philosophy doesn't stop bullets.
Exactly.
But the paper anticipates this critique by drawing on some profound scientific and philosophical grounding, specifically the work of Humberto Maturana, Francisco Varela, and the philosopher John McMurtry.
Okay, who are they?
Maturana and Varela were brilliant biologists and cognitive scientists who developed the concept of autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis, that's a heavy term. Break that down for us. What does it actually mean?
Autopoiesis literally translates to self-creation. They were studying how living cells function.
Okay.
Cells. They observed that a cell doesn't just passively sit in its environment, objectively receiving information. A cell actively interacts with its environment to maintain its own boundaries and its own life.
So it's active, not passive.
Right. Through its continuous actions and interactions, the organism essentially creates its own reality.
I see.
Maturana and Varela expanded this biological concept to human cognition. They argued that our actions don't just objectively perceive a pre-existing reality, our actions actually bring forth a world.
Bring forth a world? Meaning, the way we choose to perceive and act upon our environment fundamentally shapes the reality we are forced to live in.
Exactly. If you constantly perceive your neighbor as a deadly threat, you will act defensively, installing floodlights, buying guard dogs, building fences.
And your neighbor sees this aggressive posturing, gets scared, and buys a gun.
You have effectively brought forth a hostile world through your initial perception.
Oh, wow. So applying autopoiesis to statecraft? If Washington and Beijing continue to treat Taiwan merely as a pawn on a military chessboard, their resulting military doctrines, their hawkish rhetoric, and their aggressive economic policies will physically bring forth a world where Taiwan's violent destruction becomes a completely logical, almost inevitable strategic option.
Yes. They normalize the abstraction until immense violence becomes common sense.
That is terrifying.
But conversely, if both powers fundamentally accept what John McMurtry calls the life value ontology, it's the argument that the ultimate value of any system, whether economic or political, must be evaluated strictly by whether it enables and protects life capacities, not just money or power.
If they accept that, then what?
Then you bring forth a totally different world. You bring forth a world where certain actions, like starving an island of 23 million people, are simply unthinkable. They aren't even on the menu of options.
So to answer my own pushback, no, philosophy doesn't sink the battleship, but the philosophy adopted by a society completely determines whether that battleship is ever built, funded, and deployed in the first place.
Exactly. The mindset creates the material reality.
That is a staggering way to look at international relations. So if we manage to strip away the illusions of shallow realism, if we truly realize that negative stability isn't lasting peace, that hyper-efficient interdependence is actually hostage-taking, that tech supremacy compressing decision time is a suicide pact, and that living societies aren't poker chips.
Then what do we replace it all with?
Right. We've diagnosed the disease. We've torn down the rotting architecture of the old house. What exactly does Dr. Saifili propose we build in its place?
We move from diagnosis to the actual architecture of repair. Section 4 of the white paper outlines what he calls the five pillars of life-coherent strategic stability.
The five pillars.
This is the blueprint for a global operating system that doesn't just manage the decay of the rivalry, but actually heals the underlying structural vulnerabilities.
Let's walk through how these pillars are constructed. The first pillar focuses on the immediate bleeding, I guess, crisis non-escalation.
This is the operational triage. Before we can cure the disease, we have to ensure the patient survives the night.
Makes sense.
We desperately need to intentionally slow down decision-making processes. We need functional hotlines that connect leaders instantly, dedicated cyber clarification channels to prevent misattributions of digital attacks, and strict military-to-military deconfliction protocols.
But more deeply than just communications tech, states must culturally learn to de-escalate without suffering catastrophic humiliation.
This goes back to the idea of margin and domestic pressure we talked about earlier.
Right. In a fear-based, highly nationalist system, backing down from a confrontation is viewed as political suicide. Pride literally becomes a prison.
Exactly. If a leader feels that taking a step back makes them look irredeemably weak to their own citizens or rival factions within their government, they might consciously choose a devastating war simply to save their own political career.
That is a terrifying lack of margin.
We need diplomatic off-ramps intentionally designed to allow leaders to step back from the brink while saving face domestically.
Which leads right into the second pillar, which addresses the most immediate flashpoint, Taiwan life protection.
This operationalizes the ethical floor we just discussed. It dictates that the people of Taiwan cannot be subjected to military invasion, economic starvation, naval blockade, or forced political erasure for the sake of a great power's symbolic victory or to prove alliance credibility.
The living, breathing society must remain infinitely more real and protected than the strategic abstraction.
The rule is simple. Every single policy decision made by Beijing, Washington, and Taipei must be rigorously filtered through this test.
Does this action protect the people of Taiwan from catastrophic disruption?
And if it doesn't, it is strategically invalid.
The third pillar zooms out to look at the global circulatory system, connecting directly to our earlier discussion about hostage dependence. It's about civil commons resilience.
To understand this pillar, the paper references the brilliant work of Eleanor Ostrom.
Oh, she won the Nobel Prize in Economics, didn't she?
She did, for her research on commons governance.
This is crucial. Let's take a moment to explain the tragedy of the commons, because it's the dominant theory that Ostrom was refuting, and it dictates so much of how we view global resources.
The standard tragedy of the commons theory asks you to imagine a shared pasture open to all the local herders.
Okay, a shared pasture.
The theory argues that it is entirely rational for every individual herder to add just one more sheep to their flock to maximize their own profit.
Makes sense for the individual.
But because every herder acts with the same self-interest, the shared pasture is quickly overgrazed and destroyed, ruining everyone.
And for decades, traditional economics believed there were only two solutions to this tragedy.
Right. Either totally privatize the pasture and sell it to individuals, or have a massive top-down government take total authoritarian control of the pasture to enforce limits.
But Ostrom looked at the real world and proved that was a false binary.
She did. She traveled the world studying actual living communities, farmers in Nepal, villagers in the Swiss Alps, irrigation managers in Spain.
And what did she find?
She found that local communities, when left to themselves, often successfully self-regulate shared resources through complex, localized systems of trust, communication, and shared rules.
They didn't need total privatization or total state control. They needed cooperative community governance.
So applying Ostrom to global geopolitics, the global civil commons aren't small pastures. They are the massive shared systems of human survival.
It's the global food logistics networks, the municipal water grids, the international medicine supply chains, and crucial energy routes like the Strait of Hormuz.
A life-coherent strategy treats the protection of these global commons as the actual foundation of national security.
Yes. They must be aggressively shielded from geopolitical weaponization.
Because if your geopolitical rival can remotely turn off your municipal hospitals with a cyber attack, or if they can starve your population by legally blocking a vital shipping lane, you do not have national security, no matter how many stealth bombers you own.
The commons must be protected as a shared necessity for life, not treated as targets of opportunity.
That requires immense technological restraint, which brings us to the fourth pillar, technology under life protective constraint.
We touched on this when discussing Stanislav Petrov and AI.
The global powers must agree on unbreakable shared red lines regarding technology. You absolutely cannot have autonomous black box algorithms in charge of nuclear launch decisions.
You cannot legally permit or sanction state-sponsored cyber attacks on civilian infrastructure like hospitals or water treatment plants.
And you cannot deploy AI systems that compress military decision time to the point where human morality and deliberation are permanently removed from the loop.
The ultimate ethical test for a new military technology shouldn't just be, is it faster and more lethal?
It must be, does it ultimately protect life capacity?
And all of this culminates in the final, broadest pillar, pillar 5, planetary repair diplomacy.
This is the ultimate, inescapable realization that the United States, China, and every other nation exist on the exact same fragile rock floating in space.
Phenomena like rapid climate change, ocean acidification, and global pandemics do not respect borders. They do not care about military alliances, and they certainly do not care about the Thucydides trap.
A virus doesn't check a passport.
If great power rivalry prevents us from coordinating a massive unified response to global ecological collapse, then both powers lose, definitively, regardless of who supposedly wins the military standoff. So let me pause and ask, what does this all mean for you, the person listening to this deep dive right now?
It's the most important question.
It means realizing that the definition of national security you've been sold on the evening news is dangerously incomplete. National security isn't an abstract concept involving troop deployments in a desert 5,000 miles away.
No, national security is intensely local.
It is about whether your local power grid stays online during a winter storm. It's about whether your municipal water supply is safe from a foreign hack.
It's about whether your neighborhood hospital can function and whether the grocery store shelves will be empty next week because a shipping lane halfway across the world got blocked by a diplomatic temper tantrum.
Dr. Selly is making the forceful case that prioritizing these things isn't some weak utopian idealism. It is the absolute highest form of realism.
He calls it life-coherent realism.
A superpower cannot ultimately secure itself on a destabilized, starving, or overheating planet.
If you ruthlessly win the geopolitical chess match, but the entire board is permanently underwater, you haven't won anything.
You've just become the king of a graveyard.
Exactly.
I see the logic, and the philosophical framework is undeniably powerful. But let's bring this crashing back down to Earth for a minute.
Okay, let's do it.
We are sitting here in May 2026. The Trump C summit just happened. And as all the reporting noted, these massive leader-level summits often only produce limited, highly choreographed, symbolic breakthroughs.
It's mostly handshakes, photo ops, and vague promises.
Right. So how do we actually institutionalize this profound level of repair in the messy, bureaucratic, highly cynical real world?
That is the heavy burden of Section 5 of the paper. A philosophical shift is completely useless if it isn't operationalized.
If we just talk about autopoiesis and ostrom but change nothing, the system still collapses.
So the paper lays out specific, concrete institutional pathways to build the road toward life-coherent stability.
The first pathway tackles the immediate danger zones, Track 1 diplomacy and military risk reduction.
This goes far beyond just having a symbolic red phone on a desk. It means establishing and aggressively maintaining communication channels that are continuously tested, robust, and specifically engineered to function when trust is entirely absent.
We don't need a hotline for when relations are sunny and trade is booming.
Exactly. We need a resilient hotline for when military radars are lighting up, social media is screaming about an attack, and everyone in the command center is panicking.
It means signing ironclad standing agreements on safe maritime encounters and providing mandatory advance notification of military exercises so that a training drill isn't misinterpreted as a preemptive invasion.
The second pathway shifts the focus geographically. It's the creation of regional life protection forums.
I found this concept brilliant, actually. It argues that places like the Indo-Pacific shouldn't just be viewed by Washington and Beijing as a giant maritime theater for their militaries to flex their muscles.
Right. The Indo-Pacific isn't just a strategic map. It is home to the ASEAN nations and numerous Pacific Island countries.
For these smaller nations, the primary existential security threat isn't a superpower transition.
The threat is sea level rise, washing away their ancestral coastlines, and the total collapse of their local fisheries due to overextraction.
These regional life protection forums would give smaller nations legitimate institutional space and leverage to force the great powers to recognize and fund their life protection priorities.
Instead of just being bullied into picking a side in a new Cold War, they can demand that the superpowers compete to protect the region's ecology.
The third pathway is the legal enforcement of the commons we discussed. Civil commons compacts.
This is the rigorous legal and diplomatic shielding of life-critical systems.
It means forging binding international treaties declaring that commercial ports carrying humanitarian supplies, global food logistics networks, and public health laboratories are completely and permanently off-limits from economic sanctions, naval blockades, and cyber operations.
Just as the Geneva Conventions outlawed chemical weapons and attacks on medics, a modern compact must outlaw attacks on the digital and logistical infrastructure that keeps civilians alive.
And the fourth pathway, which honestly might be the hardest one to achieve because it requires changing human behavior at scale, public narrative repair.
This raises an important question, because this requires a massive coordinated shift from political leaders, the mainstream media, and educational institutions.
We have to actively refuse to use dehumanizing language.
We have to dismantle the enemy image absolutism that portrays the other nation as an irredeemable, cartoonish evil.
We have to actively teach the public that pursuing diplomacy is not an act of surrender, and that demonstrating military restraint is a sign of profound strength, not weakness.
If a domestic population is fed a constant daily diet of nationalist paranoia and fear-mongering, they will eventually demand a war that their leaders, trapped by their own rhetoric, cannot stop.
But this raises a really important practical question. We can set up all these regional forums, sign the civil commons compacts, and install the hotlines. But how do we actually judge if any of this is working?
Right. How do we measure diplomatic success if we aren't just counting the number of aircraft carriers or looking at GDP growth anymore?
Exactly.
The paper suggests a radical new tangible metric, an annual U.S.-China global life ground review.
Instead of a summit just producing a readout on trade deficits or defense spending, this formalized review would measure tangible physical Earth system repair.
Are global carbon emissions actually going down? Is the biodiversity of the ocean being actively protected? Are medical supply chains demonstrably becoming more resilient to shocks?
You judge the success of the diplomacy entirely by its physical, ecological, and civilizational outcomes, not by the pageantry of the summit. But I have to ask the cynical question here, because I try to look at how governments actually operate.
I was waiting for this.
Are massive bureaucracies actually going to stop and ask, excuse me, does this action preserve life capacity before they impose brutal, sweeping export controls on advanced microchips?
It's a big ask.
Do you really, truly see the U.S. Defense Department or the Chinese Politburo pausing a tense meeting to consult an ecological life ground review before launching a retaliatory cyber operation? It feels a bit like we are asking great white sharks to suddenly go vegan.
It is an incredibly steep, almost vertical uphill battle. The paper doesn't shy away from acknowledging the immense difficulty of changing entrenched bureaucratic mindsets.
So what's the answer?
Kurt Kakrasaly's response to that cynicism is essentially this. What is the alternative?
The alternative is, well, what we're doing now.
Right. Because the alternative is maintaining a system that mathematically accelerates its own fragility. The alternative is a global operating system so rigid, so brittle, and so lacking in margin that a single misidentified drone strike over the South China Sea or a regional energy blockade in the Middle East immediately triggers a cascading collapse of the global economy and potentially rapid nuclear escalation.
That's a terrifying alternative.
Institutions and metrics only matter if they successfully change what decision makers are forced to notice. If we don't build structures that force leaders to notice the physical life ground, they will simply drive the car right off the cliff while arguing fiercely over who gets to hold the steering wheel.
Wow. Okay. So to summarize our journey through this deep dive today.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really have. The Thucydides trap is ringing like a massive, deafening civilizational alarm bell right now, particularly following the tense rhetoric of the Beijing summit. But an alarm bell is just a warning. It is not a script we are forced to act out. Dr. Sahili's white paper argues brilliantly that we are currently trapped in a life-blind security paradigm where we absurdly seek safety by threatening others, entirely ignoring the fragile living ecosystems and civil commons we actually rely on to survive.
It's self-defeating.
To survive this century, we must fundamentally shift our operating system to life-coherent strategic stability. We have to treat Taiwan as a living, breathing society, not a disposable poker chip.
We must legally constrain AI decision-making.
We must aggressively shield our global food and water systems from conflict and cooperate relentlessly on planetary repair.
Because the highest form of realism is no longer dominating your enemy on a battlefield. It is ensuring the biological viability of the planet you both have to live on.
That is the metanoia, the fundamental, necessary transformation of human perception and purpose that this perilous historical moment demands of us.
It really is.
I want to leave you, the listener, with one final, provocative thought to mull over as you go about your day. It builds on everything we've discussed today, but pushes it just one step further into the future.
Okay, let's hear it.
If our ultimate non-negotiable goal is planetary life protection, if we absolutely have to save the oceans, stabilize the climate, and protect the global civil commons just to ensure human survival, is the very concept of the nation state fundamentally incompatible with that goal?
That is a massive question.
Nation states, by their very design, operate with rigid, exclusionary borders and an underlying operating system of absolute self-interest.
Right.
Are we rapidly approaching a point in human history, driven by ecological and technological realities, where we must develop a post-national identity simply to keep the Earth viable? If the biosphere doesn't respect borders, how long can our politics afford to?
It's the ultimate question. If the life ground is a singular, interconnected web, eventually our systems of governance will have to reflect that physical reality, or we simply won't survive the transition.
Think about that. The next time you look at a geopolitical map with all its rigid borders, you know, usually when we think about a global crisis, there's this expectation of geometry, a clean line, a simple math equation, a clear enemy.
But you can't solve a planetary fever with a ruler.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Dr. Sahili's incredible work. Keep questioning the geopolitical narratives you are fed in the daily news. Always look for where the margin is, and take care of the living world around you.